with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local artist David Yandell will be live with us to talk about sharing this holiday season. A new study reveals that community volunteering among Americans has reached a 30-year high, and hear how the AIDS virus may have a genetic link to malaria, according to new research.
And the cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,921 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 55,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A new report by The Lancet places the civilian death count to at least 650,000.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 8th, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. Businesses, charities, and individuals have collected 17,000 pounds of Christmas gifts for the 900 Oregon troops in Afghanistan. But the military says it can't get the presents from here to there. Public Affairs Officer of the Oregon National Guard, Kay Freistad, says military aircraft is dedicated strictly for personnel, equipment, and parts. Freistad says they cannot use taxpayers' dollars to ship comfort items to the soldiers. Salem resident Greg Warnock, executive director of the Oregon War Veterans Association, has come up with another possibility. He wants to raise $30,000 in quick cash. His group is appealing to the public to raise the money by collecting donations to transport the goods. Oregon-based Evergreen International Airlines has agreed to fly them to Afghanistan from New York. Liam.
For the first time in more than four decades, Oregon Democrats matched Republicans in voter turnout, according to final results from last month's elections. Republican turnout typically exceeds that of the Democrats by around 3 percentage points, particularly in non-presidential election years. But last month, turnout between the two parties was virtually tied at 75%. The shift of a few percentage points may seem insignificant, but it could have made the difference in some of the close legislative races that gave the Democrats a 31-29 seat majority in the State House. Overall, turnout reached 70.8%, the highest in a non-presidential election since 1990.
Dave Yandell and the guys from Radio Cab are almost ready for showtime with the Holiday Turkey Dinner Project and a big bicycle project for local children. Dave is live with us in the studio today. Thanks for being here, Dave.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Can you give us an update on the Turkey Project and...
Well, I'm very, very excited about what I feel that we're going to do. We've been working on this for a number of months, and we're ready to do over 1,000 families here in the Portland area in the next coming weeks. However, on the 16th and 17th, if people have extra turkeys or extra cans of food, we encourage you to bring them down to Radio, which is 1613 Northwest Kearney. We'd like to go quite a bit over 1,000 if at all possible.
That's a Radio Cab.
It is, yeah. Yeah. The Radio Cab Foundation actually is sponsoring this project.
Okay. And what was the address again?
1613 Northwest Kearney.
All right.
And the phone number would be 503-380-8027.
All right. For our listeners who are in a tight spot this year, how can they qualify for a dinner?
Well, very easy. If you've been you're an unemployed Portland individual, just show up down there on the 16th or 17th, proof of unemployment last year, so we'll make it happen for you. Or, of course, you can write us a letter, tell us about a family that won't have a Christmas, including yourself, and we'll make that happen too.
All right. Now, can we talk about the bike project?
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. Also, we have over 300 brand new bicycles that we're going out. They're going 50 to 6 different schools. We have Councilman Salzman, Councilman Leonard, that's going to be distributing some bikes. Serena Cruz is also going to be distributing some bikes. We got firemen, Air National Guard, we got a lot of people that I'm bringing into the schools with this project.
Mm-hmm. Can people still contribute to the bike project? What do you need?
Really what we need is more money and more turkeys and more canned food for that particular project. We pretty well got the bike project funded and sealed.
Mm-hmm. And, well, you gave us your telephone number already, but can you repeat it again?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's 503-380-8027.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was David Yandel with Radio Cab. Thank you, David, and enjoy the holidays.
Republican Senator Gordon Smith, who voted in favor of the Iraq war and has supported it ever since, now says the current U.S. war effort is absurd and may even be criminal. In a major speech on the Senate floor last night, the Oregon senator called for rapid pullouts of U.S. troops from Iraq, and he said he would never have voted for the conflict if he had known the intelligence that Bush gave the American people was inaccurate, citing the hundreds of billions of dollars spent and the nearly 3,000 American deaths. Smith said, "I, for one, am at the end of my rope when it comes to supporting a policy that has our soldiers patrolling the same streets in the same way, being blown up by the same bombs day after day. That is absurd. It may even be criminal. So either we clear and hold and build, or let's go home." While expressing grave doubts about the Iraq war, Smith said he does not believe the United States can retreat from the larger war on terror. But Smith added, "We have no business being a policeman in someone else's civil war."
Citizens from Douglas and surrounding counties are meeting twice this weekend to discuss how to stop a proposed liquefied natural gas pipeline. If built, the pipeline could ultimately transport 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas across southwest Oregon every day. The Southern Oregon Clean Energy Coalition and Citizens Against Liquefied Natural Gas will meet at 1 p.m. on Saturday at the Canyonville Youth Center and at 1 p.m. on Sunday at the Medford Public Library. They intend to stop the proposed Pacific Connector, a 225-mile-long, 3-foot diameter pipeline, which will require ground easements and in some cases up to 100 feet wide across private and public property. After conversion from a liquefied state to a gaseous state at Goose Bay's proposed terminal Jordan Cove, the Pacific Connector would transport natural gas to a conduit in Malin. If constructed, the connector will cross much of Douglas County on its way.
Americans see no easy exit from Iraq. Just 9% expect the war to end in clear-cut victory, compared with 87% who expect some sort of compromise settlement, according to the latest AP Ipsos poll. The numbers evoke parallels to public opinion about the war in Vietnam 40 years ago. In December 1965, when the American side of the war still had 8 years to run, a Gallup survey found just 7% believed it would end in victory. Dissatisfaction with Bush's handling of Iraq has climbed to an all-time high of 71%, according to the AP Ipsos survey, which was taken as a bipartisan commission was releasing its recommendations this week for a new course. Just 27% of Americans approved of Bush's handling of Iraq, down from his previous low of 31% in November.
Right-wing radio host Rush Limbaugh called the Baker-Hamilton Commission, quote, the Iraq Surrender Group, close quote. The conservative New York Post tabloid doctored a front-page photo to depict the co-chairs of the Iraq Study Group in primate fur under the headline Surrender Monkeys, inspired by a frequently quoted line from the sitcom The Simpsons. Conservative commentator William Bennett vented in volcanic fashion, "In all my time in Washington, I have never seen such smugness, arrogance, or such insufferable moral superiority." Howls of protest echoed across the right side of the political spectrum as conservatives voiced dismay with the findings of the bipartisan Iraq panel released on Wednesday. The commission's report depicts Iraq as a country sliding into chaos, saying conditions are grave and deteriorating. Many conservatives agree with that assessment. However, the report's other findings and recommendations, which include direct talks with Syria and Iran, clearly struck a nerve with the most ardent supporters of the war. Liam?
Lawyers for outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other high-ranking U.S. military officials were on the defensive today at the U.S. federal court in D.C. As Rumsfeld shed tears during an emotional farewell reception a few miles away at the Pentagon, Rumsfeld's attorneys were asking a judge to dismiss lawsuits brought by human rights groups representing victims of torture in U.S. military detention facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. FSRN's Ingrid Drake has the story from Washington.
Seeing that, that what went on there and feeling so deeply sorry that happened.
Outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld expressed remorse about the U.S. military's use of torture and humiliation at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq this morning.
I remember being stunned by the news of the abuse at Abu Ghraib, and then watching so many determined people spend so many months trying to figure out exactly how in the world something like that could have happened, and how to make it right.
At the same time, attorneys defending Rumsfeld against a lawsuit filed by Afghan and Iraqi civilians tortured at U.S. military facilities argued that the U.S. courts should drop the case because it would chill the conduct of the military and distract from the duty of fighting. Cecilia Wong with the ACLU challenged the government's position that the judicial branch should not intrude on military functions.
It's a shame that we are here in court dealing with a case in which high-ranking U.S. military officials engaged in a policy of torture. What's also shameful is that those defendants' lawyers are in court trying to evade responsibility and trying to tell the court that it has no power to act because of procedural technicalities that simply don't apply.
Underscoring that torture is awful, the defense attorneys said that the military justice system is the appropriate forum for punishing detainee abuse and has already prosecuted 105 service members for such abuse. The judge challenged this claim by saying Rumsfeld was directly involved with giving the orders of certain interrogation methods and other clear violation of rights. Deborah Perlstein, an attorney with Human Rights First.
There is some argument in this case that's been advanced by the government about whether or not these questions are not properly before a court at all, whether these are political questions, whether there are special factors that would counsel against a court of the United States issuing a judgment on the question whether the right against torture has been violated. And I think both from the military leaders who filed an amicus brief and as we saw in court today, these are quintessentially legal questions. Every branch of the government agrees that the policy was wrong. Now it's to the courts to say it wasn't just bad policy, it was against the law. And I think that's what we hope we'll find here.
Citing 10,000 pages of evidence, friend of the court briefs from former military officers and international lawyers, Lucas Guttentag of the ACLU says they have a strong case, which in addition to Rumsfeld, names Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, former Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, and Colonel Thomas Pappas. Attorney Lucas Guttentag.
A case like this has never been squarely presented because there's never been the kind of overwhelming evidence of systemic abuse based on orders and authorizations by the Secretary of Defense and other high-level officials.
The main argument for dismissal of the case was that non-citizens are not protected by the U.S. Constitution and that ruling on their torture claims would release a floodgate of cases against the U.S. military. In addition to compensation for the innocent civilians tortured by U.S. military personnel, the case also seeks to make clear that torture is a violation of domestic and international law to prevent future abuse. Again, Lucas Guttentag.
We're seeking a declaration that the defendants violated the Constitution and international law, and we're seeking compensation for our clients, and we're seeking an order that what was done here by these defendants is unconstitutional and a violation of international law in order to deter future actions and conduct of this kind.
Attorneys for the military also said that the U.S. Congress approved the means chosen by the Defense Department to carry out its military goals in Iraq and Afghanistan. While no date has been given, Judge Hogan said he will rule on whether to dismiss the case in the not-too-distant future. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Outgoing Georgia Representative Cynthia McKinney announced a bill today to impeach President Bush. The legislation has no chance of passing and serves as a symbolic parting shot, not only at Bush, but also at Democratic leaders. It has been a day of attacks against longtime Republican lawmakers around the country. In the red state of Alaska, a grand jury has indicted Thomas T. Anderson, a current member of the Alaska State House of Representatives, on charges of extortion, conspiracy, bribery, and money laundering. The targets of an FBI investigation, Alaska State Senate President Ben Stevens and staffers at oil company Veko, are now walking on eggshells. And observers are waiting for similar words on Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. His office was raided at the same time as Anderson in August of this year.
Research indicates that the touch of a loved one can boost the immune system, halt or slow the progress of disease, and reduce the experience of pain. Scientists have guessed that touch communicates emotion. When Jim Cohen at Virginia University scanned the brains of married women in pain, he spotted changes that may help to shed light on an age-old mystery. As soon as the women touched the hands of their husbands, there was an instant drop in activity in the areas of the brain involved in fear, danger, and threat. The women who had been exposed to experimental pain while they were scanned were calmer and less stressed, and a similar but smaller effect was triggered by the touch of strangers. While touch is used extensively for stress and anxiety and in palliative care, research is now increasingly focusing on whether it can impede the progress of a number of diseases, including depression and cancer.
And now, just over 60 minutes after 5 o'clock, time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Like something from a 1950s horror movie, they came from afar, wriggling into our waterways, endangering our very ecosystem, and threatening human safety. These things are fearsome alien species. They are not creatures from outer space, but invasive, aggressive, highly prolific fish species that have arrived from foreign shores to infest America's waterways. With such names as northern snakeheads, Chinese mitten crabs, and Asian carp, they are reproducing like rabbits on Viagra, wreaking havoc with their sheer numbers, size, and destructive abilities. Take the Asian carp, please. On the Illinois River and elsewhere, these giants have displaced the native carp and are so big that they rip right through fishing nets. There are millions of them, and they leap so powerfully from the water that it's common for boaters to get seriously whacked by them. We certainly can't take our kids or grandkids out on the river, bemoans one longtime waterman. On the other hand, these big leapers have spawned a new sport called the Redneck Rodeo. Participants either try to shoot the fish in the air or, more benignly, simply grab the leaping carp. Also, schools of tilapia now swarm in Pennsylvania's Monongahela River. Zebra mussels have altered the balance of life in Lake Erie. And Chinese mitten crabs are damaging the banks of waterways from San Francisco Bay to Baltimore Harbor. The invaders come in the ballast water of global freighters, are spread by the sprawling aquaculture industry, or are released by people who bring in exotic species. Since our fragile ecosystem is inextricably connected, a seemingly innocent introduction of a species in one place can quickly become an invasion many miles away. This is Jim Hightower saying, you see, it's not the fault of the fish, it's ours. Once again, the human footprint is stomping on Mother Nature.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast at 5:30, then Bread and Roses at 6 o'clock. At 7, it's Jay's Place. Tomorrow's weather, rain showers in the morning becoming more intermittent throughout the day with a high of 47, and in the Columbia Gorge, steady rain with a high of 38. You're listening to the Cable Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Continuing violence has left more than 3 million Iraqis displaced inside and in neighboring countries. A shortfall in donations has left the United Nations High Commission for Refugees with a projected budget for Iraq that is less than half of this year's budget of $29 million. FSRN's David Enders reports from Amman, Jordan.
Like many Iraqi women in the Jordanian capital, 50-year-old Sabah survives by selling cigarettes on a bustling downtown sidewalk. She says that she has been in Jordan illegally since fleeing Iraq to look for work in 1993, and like most Iraqis in Jordan, she does not have access to public services like medical care.
I'm alone here. All my children are in Iraq.
Access to education and the ability to work legally are also barriers. The UNHCR estimates more than 1.5 million Iraqis are internally displaced, more than half of those since 2003, and that another 1.5 million are refugees in neighboring countries, the majority having left in the last 3 years, mostly to Jordan and Syria. The UNHCR budget for its Iraq program has decreased steadily from a high of $150 million since 2003. One-fourth of that is used for Iraqis living in neighboring countries. The UNHCR has virtually no staff working in central Iraq, the violence in the country having long since forced relocation to the Kurdish north. The budget is so low that in the case of Syria, roughly $1 has been allocated for each refugee there. Robert Breen is the UNHCR representative in Jordan and says that right after the invasion, the focus was on helping Iraqis who had left during Saddam Hussein's regime return to Iraq.
Clearly, for the last several years, there's been a neglect to the consequences of the Iraq conflict.
Breen says his office is now focusing on increasing awareness of the problem amongst donor countries. In the past, the major donors to UNHCR's Iraq program have been the U.S., European Union nations, Japan, and Australia. Breen also pointed out that many Iraqis simply cannot leave Iraq. As the war has continued and violence has occasionally spilled into Jordan, restrictions on travel for Iraqis have become tougher, for those who can even clear the initial hurdles necessary to travel. Abu Othman, an Iraqi from Baghdad who said he had traveled to Jordan on business and had already overstayed his visa and would have to pay a fine in order to return to Iraq, said his family has already moved once to escape sectarian violence that has swept Baghdad neighborhoods. Abu Othman said he would like to leave, but as a Sunnah, he was afraid to take his children to the government office that issues passports in Baghdad.
The militias that run the country have people at the passport offices. They don't allow people from one sect to get a passport.
He added that recently, a 20-year-old nephew had been abducted at a police checkpoint and killed, apparently because he was a Sunnah. In Amman, I'm David Enders for FSRN.
The Irish aid agency GOAL will withdraw its remaining international staff from Darfur because of the deteriorating security situation in the region. In a statement, GOAL said today the situation had forced it to withdraw all remaining international staff from Darfur. After 3 years of work providing humanitarian relief to 220,000 war victims, the move comes ahead of a worldwide day of protests over Darfur on Sunday. GOAL's founder John O'Shea said that for the last 3 years they've begged the international community to send in an international peacekeeping force to protect innocent civilians and keep the aid channels open, but those cries have fallen on deaf ears, forcing them to make this very difficult decision. Several GOAL vehicles have been hijacked in recent months, and a GOAL staff member was killed during a forced emergency evacuation earlier this year. 13 aid workers have been killed in Darfur since the signing of a peace agreement in May.
The International Committee of the Red Cross said on Thursday it was sharply cutting its budget for Sudan next year and halting food distribution in Darfur as more people are able to harvest their own crops despite the fighting. The humanitarian agency is currently feeding 300,000 people, which is around a tenth of those deemed in need. in remote areas of Sudan's troubled western region especially, but this group is now considered largely self-sufficient in food, a spokesperson said. The ICRC budget for Sudan will be cut by 43% as it shifts from large-scale food distribution in Darfur to activities such as seed distribution and other income-generating projects. The Sudan will remain its largest single operation worldwide. The neutral Swiss-based agency visits prisoners of war and other detainees to monitor their treatment, and it provides emergency aid after disasters and monitors compliance with international humanitarian law, including the 1949 Geneva Conventions.
Scientists looking at AIDS in Kenya say there may be a link between malaria and the spread of HIV. The research carried out by the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and the University of Washington found that when people with HIV contracted malaria, it increased the HIV viral load in the carrier's blood, making it easier to transmit to a sexual partner. In turn, people weakened by HIV infection are more susceptible to malaria. They estimate tens of thousands of HIV infections could be caused by this co-infection.
The Occidental Petroleum Company announced it will withdraw from Peru and indicated that they are waiting just for the approval of the Peruvian government. FSRN's Pamela Cueva reports from Lima.
The Vice President of Public Matters of the Oxy, Lawrence Merriott, explained that the decision has been taken based on a combination of technical matters and the confrontations with the communities. They indicate that Oxy has communicated to President Alan Garcia their intentions to cease every activity in Peru and to leave the country. The decision of the American company occurred right after the visit to Los Angeles by a group of leaders from the Achuar communities protesting against the constant contamination that affects their territories. This contamination of local waters and livestock has resulted in dangerous high levels of heavy metals found in local residents. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadras from Lima, Peru.
6 years after a teenage Zambian tailor started using his only sewing machine to make free school uniforms for AIDS orphans, the organization he founded has won the Red Ribbon Grand Prize of $20,000, part of a new UN effort to honor grassroots generosity on World AIDS Day last Friday. Johnson Habachimba was 18 when he began sewing free uniforms. Using funds he had generated from his business as a tailor, he provided the uniforms to local AIDS orphans. This year, a local rural development chapter gave uniforms to 41 children so they could continue their education. The prize money could mean for Habachimba that as many as 100 free uniforms could be provided next year, along with free shoes and school books. It will also allow his chapter to buy more sewing machines and train more young people to help do the work. The work has been hailed as an example of how local groups are tackling the broader public effects of AIDS, such as disrupting education and aggravating poverty, beyond the already enormous impact it has on an individual's health.
A group of English cricket fans watching their team play in Australia were so desperate for a curry from their favourite chef that they ordered one from Britain, and the restaurant's managers promised to deliver. Nasir Abdul, manager of the Bombay Nights restaurant in Bath, Western England, said it was the farthest takeaway order the restaurant had ever received, although it had flown food to Germany for Football World Cup fans this year. Abdul and his business partner hope to fly to Perth on Monday to deliver several orders of dishes that contain lamb meat. The cost is £1,500 for food that would normally cost about £140. The food will be chilled and put in cooler boxes inside their suitcases for the 9,000-mile journey. He hopes Australian customs will not confiscate the food, because they just veggie might. That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 8, 2006, marking the 1,908th day since Bush made the declaration he'd catch Osama bin Laden dead or alive. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. And that goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our wire editor is Martha Odom, and tonight's audio editor is also Noah Eaton. Our engineer is Brian Averill, and the KBOO News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, who we all here at KBOO thank wholeheartedly for her commitment and spirit to this very special news family. Bless you, Lisa, and thank you very much. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, here the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. Their guest is local performance artist Damali Ayo, author of How to Rent a Negro. The topic is racism. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour with news, views, reviews, and interviews from the underground. At 10 on Health Watch, Eve Sokolai's guest host. She speaks with Felicia Eves, National Campaign Coordinator for Women's Voices for the Earth and a board member of the National Black Environmental Justice Network, and Diane Lund of Rachel's Friends Breast Cancer Coalition. They'll discuss the movement to make sure that cosmetics are free of harmful chemicals and the Safe Cosmetics Act, which will be introduced in the Oregon legislature next year. At 10:30 on the Dirtbag, the guest is Metro Waste Reduction Educator Frida Sherburn, who will discuss the many helpful qualities of earthworms. And at 11, Democracy Now!
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, if you're a Beltway pundit or media big shot, the report issued by the Iraq Study Group was a big deal. The group's recommendations were page one fodder for days on end. But a good question to ask might be, why? While the report dazzled the press corps, what about the rest of us? Tom Engelhardt of the Nation Institute will join us to talk about it. Also on the show, World AIDS Day came and went, and much like with Labor Day, an issue that could provide compelling stories every day of the week has been relegated once again to back pages. It's surely this kind of lackluster treatment that helps generate what our guest calls a major gap between the world's understanding of AIDS and the conversation here in the U.S. Yifat Suskind is Communications Director for MADRE, the Women's Human Rights Organization. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Who are acceptable war critics to the mainstream media? New York Times reporter Michael Gordon offered one answer on December 4th in an article that focused on the fact that retired General Anthony Zinni, allegedly a critic of the war, advocates sending more troops. To buttress this argument, Gordon stressed that no military expert was more forthright in opposing the Iraq War than Zinni. But Zinni wasn't exactly leading anti-war marches. A Washington Post article before the war quoted him saying that he didn't object to military action against Iraq and that, quote, we should have done it a long time ago, close quote. So what exactly is Gordon's point? It seemed mostly that he's trying to establish a limit on one side of the Iraq debate. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius did much the same recently when he he devoted an entire column to praising Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, who, quote, can claim to have been right about Iraq and other key issues earlier than almost any national politician, close quote. Post readers would have presumably thought then that Hagel voted against the war. But he didn't. So how is Hagel more right about Iraq than those who tried to prevent the war? Well, like Michael Gordon, Ignatius was voicing the establishment's conventional wisdom that no matter what has happened, those who truly opposed the Iraq War from the start should not get any credit for being right. Ignatius, to his credit, acknowledged in a subsequent column that Democrats who oppose the war should get some attention. Let's see if others in the media follow suit.
On December 5th, the New York Times covered a new report from an Israeli research group defending Israel against accusations of war crimes in its recent war with Lebanon. But instead of weighing the report against international law or independent human rights groups, the paper of record chose to pass on the report's spin without question. The crux of the debate in the Times is that Israel has been accused of war crimes for firing on civilian areas. Israel, meanwhile, argues that, quote, Hezbollah fired from civilian areas, itself a war crime, which made those areas legitimate targets, close quote. Well, first of all, it's important to note that the accusations against Israel are actually much more extensive, including the use of cluster bombs and white phosphorus, and the bombing of power plants and other civilian infrastructure. But even on the narrow point the Times addresses, basic journalism would require one to interview independent experts to see how the Israeli report holds up. Instead, the paper pulled quotes from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International that, strangely, were not directly relevant to the central issue, giving the impression that those groups didn't address the justification being put forth by Israel. But both groups did exactly that, explaining that Hezbollah's actions would not permit Israel to disregard international law. On December 7th, after a fair action alert, the Times issued a half-hearted correction, acknowledging an error with their Amnesty International citation. The Times skipped the much more glaring error, though, namely that attacking civilian targets, however you like, is not permitted under international law. Correction or not, then, the Times still gave its readers virtually nothing but Israeli talking points.
In December 4th, New York Times Profile called CNN headline news host Glenn Beck brash and opinionated and said he, quote, takes credit for saying what others are feeling but are afraid to say, close quote. Maybe that's what he was doing when he recently told newly elected Congressman Keith Ellison, who is Muslim, quote, sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies, close quote. As offensive as that is, as Eric Alterman pointed out on his blog, it doesn't begin to capture the true poison of Beck's rhetoric about Muslims. On his August 10th Clear Channel syndicated radio show, Beck suggested that unless good Muslims signed up to shoot bad Muslims in the head, all Muslims might be put into camps. As Beck explained, when Americans feel threatened, quote, they will put razor wire up, and just based on the way you look or just based on your religion, they will round you up, close. Quote. Well, Beck called that Nazi World War II wrong, but he wasn't exactly condemning the idea. On his September 5th headline news show, Beck suggested yet again that another attack on the U.S. and, quote, Muslims and Arabs will be looking through a razor wire fence at the West, close quote. You didn't read that in the New York Times Profile. You did, however, learn that Beck's show is a success because he's getting good ratings. Now, Beck does say that if Arabs and Muslims change their behavior, they may be able to avoid the grotesque history that Japanese Americans faced during World War II. We would suggest that one way to avoid repeating that history is for media outlets to take people seriously when they start threatening others with concentration camps, rather than merely cheering their ratings success.
For some right-wingers, bloody wars with thousands of human beings dead are one thing, but what's really tearing at the fabric of the country is incivility. George Will used his November 30th Washington Post column to take newly elected Democratic Senator Jim Webb to task for what Will called the gross offense of calculated rudeness toward another human being. The rudeness occurred, as listeners may have heard by now, when Webb refused to pass through a reception line at the White House and had a terse exchange with George W. Bush. Here's how George Will recounts that exchange. Quote, when Bush asked Webb, whose son is a Marine in Iraq, how's your boy? Webb replied, I'd like to get them out of Iraq. When the president again asked, "How's your boy?" Webb replied, "That's between me and my boy," close quote. For George Will, this proves Webb a bore and a pompous poser, undeserving of the dignity of public office. Not just because he was disrespectful to Bush the president, you understand, but to Bush the man who, quote, disregarding many hard things Webb had said about him during the campaign, asked a civil and caring question as one parent to another, close quote. Now, many people might think Webb was just expressing his feelings, though less colorfully than, say, Dick Cheney. But what makes Will's harangue even more off point is that he had to doctor the conversation in order to make Webb, in his mind, come off worse. In the Washington Post's own news reporting of the incident, which ran the day before Will's column, reporter Michael Shear wrote that when Bush asked, "How's your boy?" and Webb answered, "I'd like to get them out of Iraq," Bush then countered, "That's not what I asked you. How's your boy?" It was at this point that Webb responded, "That's between me and my boy, Mr. President," ending the exchange. Surely, if George Will had reported the conversation accurately, he would have had a harder sell presenting Bush's comments as those of a caring parent, and Webb's response as inexplicably rude. So the columnist's solution was evidently just to tweak the facts a little to more comfortably suit his goal. And presumably, to hope his readers hadn't read the paper the day before.
And finally, George W. Bush's status as a lame duck seems clearer by the day. That means some in the media seem more interested in perhaps telling it like it is. In the December 11th issue of Newsweek, for example, we learn, in case we didn't know it already, that Bush doesn't like to hear what he doesn't want to hear. As Newsweek tells it, quote, "One of the myths that the Bush camp has tried to perpetuate over the years is that the president follows the model, learned as a student at Harvard Business School, of a chief executive who delegates, listens to advice, and only then decides," close quote. Well, if all that hubbub about Bush's Harvard MBA management style was a myth sold to the media, there was at least one eager buyer: Newsweek magazine. Between 2000 and 2002, the magazine referred to Bush's advise and decide style seven times. In July 2000, Newsweek cited the virtues of delegation Bush learned at Harvard. A month later, we were told that Bush developed his approach to leadership there to delegate and decide. In December, in case we'd forgotten, Newsweek reminded us that Harvard taught Bush, quote, "to delegate, to surround yourself with the best and rise with them," close quote. In March of 2002, Newsweek reported that Bush's war on terror management had its roots in, quote, "the classrooms of the Harvard Business School," close quote. So if this was a myth, and one constantly repeated by Newsweek before the 2000 election and after, what does that make Newsweek?
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin's brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Well, whatever you make of it, the report issued by the Iraq Study Group on December 6th certainly did not suffer from a lack of media interest. The group's consensus findings were slowly leaked to the press in the days ahead of the official release, causing a media frenzy that seemed oddly disconnected from anything the group was actually saying. So why did this Blue Ribbon Commission get such breathless coverage? And once the report was out, did it actually amount to, as one Washington Post report dubbed it, an improvised explosive device beneath the Bush administration's Iraq policy? Well, joining us now to talk it over is Tom Engelhart. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute and creator of the website TomDispatch.com. Tom Engelhart, welcome to Counterspin.
Hi.
Well, the piece you wrote ahead of the Iraq Study Group's eventual release was called "How to Stay in Iraq." Well, that's a far cry from how the media is portraying the group's finding, which were a little hard to parse. Yes, there's troop withdrawal, but then again, no, there isn't. What struck you as the report was finally making its way out to official release?
Well, it was the same thing that struck me the day before when Secretary of Defense nominee Robert Gates was praised for his candor, for saying what all Americans know, basically, at this point, which is that the war is lost. But his real candor was that he said very clearly in exactly the words of the Iraq Study Group report, not surprising since he was on the group, that we would be in Iraq for some time. And I think that's probably the crucial thing that hasn't been dealt with. The actual plan, once you read the report, but it was clear before the report even came out, is to withdraw combat forces, which, oddly enough, are not combat forces. That is, The combat forces they're talking about add up to maybe 50 or 60,000 American troops, but all sorts of other American troops, including the troops guarding the Green Zone, people doing logistics stuff, special reaction forces, special operations forces, and the possibly 20,000 advisors who are being rushed in, supposedly, to make the Iraqi army do what we haven't been able to do, will add up to about 80,000 people, my guess anyway, who will be in Iraq in sometime in 2008. So the withdrawal that's being talked about is really the withdrawal of a certain part of the forces, and it's not even clear from the plan whether those troops are to be withdrawn from Iraq or to our giant bases in Iraq, which are seldom, the report does discuss them, but they're seldom mentioned in the media. We've got these huge multi-million, billion-dollar bases, small towns, actually, that really reek of permanency, as they always have. So what you really have is you've got the U.S. in Iraq deep into 2008 with no plan beyond that, basically. And in addition, the rest of the Iraq study report is curious in a number of ways. One is that they continue to urge the privatization of the Iraqi oil industry, which was basically the Bush plan. They are suggesting all sorts of things with the supposedly sovereign Iraqi government, changing the national police from the Interior Ministry to the Defense Ministry, flooding departments with American advisors, none of which have anything to do with Iraqi sovereignty or anything else. So what you have, I think, here underneath all this is a pretty striking effort to kind of solidify a disaster.
For the most part, the media impression you get is somewhat the opposite. The Washington Post said this was nothing less than a repudiation of the White House. During CNN's Larry King Live for the entire hour, the graphic underneath said, "Change course now," with an exclamation point. You wrote a piece for The Nation, thenation.com, the headline was "The People's Iraq Study Group," and this brings up, I think, an interesting point about public opinion about Iraq. It certainly hasn't played a significant factor in the Iraq debate to date. Perhaps it will be even less important now that we have this blue ribbon panel weighing in. One Washington Post story today oddly referred to the debate over withdrawing troops as something that, in their words, threatened to disrupt the careful consensus its members had tried to forge. What's the distance, you think, between the public mood and public opinion and the Iraq Study Group?
Well, what's striking, and again, I've leafed through two major papers today, The Times and The Washington Post, without finding what was in some ways yesterday's most striking news, which was that the respected polling organization PIPA released a report on post-election American attitudes towards Iraq, which shows that indeed the American people have formed their own Iraq Study Group. Their consensus, with the exception of an overlap on the obvious same need to talk to neighbors in the region, Iran and Syria, to form some kind of international conference, but beyond that, they've moved way beyond this at best timid program. The PIPA figures show that, for instance, 58% of Americans want all American troops withdrawn on an actual timeline. There's none in the ISG report within 2 years at a maximum. 77% of Americans, if the Iraqi government would ask us to withdraw within a year, want us to jump at that possibility, including 72% of Republicans, which I think is interesting. And the other figures go along rather like this. 60-odd percent of Americans do not want us to have permanent bases in Iraq, which is fascinating since permanent bases are never discussed in the media, and yet that feeling is there. There is a consensus, I think, in the country that is about this debacle in Iraq that goes way beyond what the so-called middle ground in Washington turns out to be. And by the one thing I would add is that the way in which those headlines you quoted were accurate is, I think, while this may not be an IED, that is a roadside explosive underneath the Bush policy in Iraq, I think the Iraq Study Group has been a kind of IED under the Bush administration, which is another matter. That is, I think there is a kind of this is why it's taken so long, almost the gestation period for a human baby, to come to these rather pallid recommendations, which is that there is a kind of a struggle within that Washington world between kind of the old establishment, the father Bush's world, and the son's world of neocons and so on and so forth. And in that way, I think that the Iraq Study Group has actually made some real inroads into the administration, obviously, particularly in the Pentagon.
This does get to a kind of a fundamental media question, why the press has invested so much in the Iraq Study Group. You see headlines about the realists coming back, and I think that's what you're referring to. It almost seems like the process involved in all this is more important than the product. Washington Post columnist David Broder, who's a pretty reliable indicator of media conventional wisdom, was praising the commission as a model for how we could solve any vexing political problems, Social Security and the like. It does seem like the way they went about this and the folks who were in the group was just as important as what this group might actually say about anything.
Yes, I think that's true. I think the realism they're talking about is an inside the Beltway realism. And what's striking, and you can actually find some pieces. There was a decent Washington Post piece on this, kind of just not the major piece today. What they're suggesting militarily, for instance, just more advisors, looks like another kind of madness. Based on what's already happened in Iraq, there's no reason to believe our experience with advisors with the Iraqi army, which is basically a bunch of armed militias, has been absolutely dismal. And advisors have been writing about this. You know, I mean, the American advisors aren't trained to deal with this. We don't have the numbers. They've been remarkably unsuccessful in supposedly standing up the Iraqi army, which is not the Iraqi army. And as this plan works it out, this army will be an army infiltrated not only with Shiite militias and Sunni militias, but it will be an army infiltrated with vast numbers of American advisors, so that it will be an American army, not an Iraqi army, in terms of its command structure, for sure.
Doesn't sound like a withdrawal to me. Well, we've been speaking with Tom Engelhart. He's a fellow of the Nation Institute, editor of the website tomdispatch.com. A new collection of Tom Dispatch interviews is out now. It's called Mission Unaccomplished. Tom Engelhart, thanks for joining us here on Counterspin.
It's a pleasure.
Judging by the country's leading newspapers, World AIDS Day, marked each year on December 1st, is kind of like Arbor Day, occasion for a few hundred words, maybe a photo. The Los Angeles Times, for example, ran a photo of a balloon launch and a tiny wire item in the World in Brief section. Many outlets do add a high-minded editorial, like the San Francisco Chronicle, which called for more imagination and progress in fighting HIV/AIDS. All of that is fine as far as it goes, but decades into a pandemic that now affects tens of millions of people, in which U.S.-driven political and economic inequity blocks treatment for millions, it's fair to say that just isn't far enough. What can journalists do to take the AIDS story beyond the usual static, isn't it sad, frame? And what can we all do to push journalists and the broader conversation to more active and more hopeful ground? That's the subject of a recent column by our next guest. Yifat Suskind is the communications director at the international women's human rights organization, MADRE. Her column, Abstaining from Greed and Dogma, the AIDS Policy We Should Call For in 2007, ran recently on the Common Dreams Newswire and elsewhere. Yifat Suskind joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, your piece starts off by pointing to a gap between the world's collective understanding of how to fight AIDS and U.S. policy, which seems to be pulling in the other direction. Clearly, the administration, be it Republican or Democratic, drives policy most directly. But I wonder, what role do you think U.S. media play in shaping the public understanding of AIDS and AIDS policy?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, one is a story that's reported, which I'd like to see reported differently, and the other is a story that we just don't see at all. What we've been seeing, especially lately, is a tremendous focus on sort of celebrity endorsement of AIDS advocacy work and a very, I would say, narrow focus on the work of a few kind of high visibility, very wealthy people, Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, you know, at the top of that list. And while it's great to see people using whatever means they have to raise awareness of AIDS, what we've seen mostly through the media is a kind of reinforcement of messages that actually in a lot of cases are at odds with what people who are on the grounds doing AIDS advocacy in the places where people are most affected by the disease are calling for. And that's the story that we don't see. And we're not seeing those stories in large measure because they don't jibe with the policy of the Bush administration. And that happens in two ways. I mean, you know, everything that we know about combating the AIDS pandemic at this point points to the need for two things, and that's prevention work and treatment work that go together. It's common sense, right? Mm-hmm. You work to prevent the virus from spreading and work to treat people who already have the disease. On both of those counts, what we're seeing from the Bush administration and very closely reflected in the media, there's not a lot of criticism here at all of the fact that prevention policy, on the one hand, has really been given over by this administration to the religious right in this country, and treatment policy is really dictated, and that's not hyperbole to use that word, dictated by the pharmaceutical industry.
And, of course, mainstream media don't, as a rule, take up critical positions against corporations, whether they be pharmaceutical corporations or any other. Well, one of the other things that we find in media is a kind of tendency to editorially reward what is portrayed as centrism or moderation, but that places the most reasonable position between whatever has been identified as the poles, and sometimes that's wildly inappropriate, as here. On AIDS, it can mean kind of people in poor countries and poor people in this country want to have access to life-saving drugs. Big drug companies don't want them to. If the truth is in the middle, the truth is, what does that really mean?
Right, absolutely. And what we're seeing from the media, sometimes in a best case scenario, are these kind of feel good stories about, you know, people with access to money and media and privilege calling for, you know, donations or reduced prices from pharmaceutical companies. You know, that's been a lot of the work of the Clinton Foundation in recent months. And obviously, any time someone gets access to medicine, that's a good thing. But as far as addressing the magnitude of the crisis and really making some systemic changes in how the world is going about addressing the disease, charity from corporations that don't really want to give it is not the way to go. We're used to seeing stories that lead us to believe that the best thing we could possibly hope for here is corporate charity. And that's not the case. First of all, the countries of the global south, the countries where 95% of people living with AIDS are not asking for charity. What they're asking for is a change in the rules that would enable them to produce their own AIDS drugs. And that is technology and scientific knowledge that they already have. They don't need charity. You know, the governments of Brazil, India, South Africa, Thailand, they have the capacity to produce AIDS medicines. The problem is not that they're off in the dark ages of the third world and they can't produce their own medicines. That's what we're led to believe when we see stories about magnanimous wealthy people in the U.S. haggling with drug companies to get AIDS medicines donated. What we need to see is international trade rules that support governments' abilities to produce and sell generic AIDS drugs. The reason generics are so important is because they have driven down the cost of these medicines by as much as 98%. I mean, that's just huge, and that's exactly the reason that the drug companies don't want to see generics being used on a large scale, for example, by the U.S. International AIDS Program. The fact is, though, that the United States actually already agreed to these demands back in 2001 at World Trade Organization talks in Doha. They agreed with the demands of southern governments and a lot of aid advocates that life-saving drugs should not be bound by patent rules that are aimed only at maximizing profits. That's not a utopian demand. That's something that's already on the books. The problem is that the Bush administration has been skirting those commitments by drafting bilateral trade deals, you know, trade deals with individual countries that don't include those provisions. So, for example, this summer there was a trade deal passed with a consortium of countries in Central America, and the government of Guatemala, where there is a growing AIDS crisis, had to reverse a policy of importing generic AIDS drugs. You know, what's hanging in the balance literally are the lives of millions of people. So, you know, this is not about ideology or morality or any kind of abstraction. It's really about people's lives. And the crime here really is that those governments that are denied the possibility to produce and sell generic AIDS medicines have that capacity. They're not asking for anyone's help.
It sounds as though to follow this story really to all the places where it ought to go, it's going to have to be more than a once-a-year parachute-in type of deal.
Absolutely. And what would be great, you know, what I would love to see is some stories that focus not on, you know, Bono or Bill Gates, but on women in communities that are creating all kinds of very innovative and very effective programs to combat AIDS. And those include getting AIDS medicines into the hands of people who need it most, even without infrastructure and functioning health systems in places like Haiti. And also creating, you know, prevention programs that really understand that in order to fight AIDS, we really need to promote human rights in general so that people can make the best choices for their health. And those things are happening, and it would be a lot easier to feel hopeful about doing something about the AIDS crisis if people had more access through the media to stories that made it clear that that work is happening.
We've been speaking with Yifat Suskind. She's communications director at MADRE, the Women's Human Rights Organization. You can find their work on the web at madre.org. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
The publisher of the Portland Alliance invites you to celebrate 25 years of non-corporate community publishing. On Saturday, December 9th, you are invited to a fundraiser, dinner, auction, and celebration of the Portland Alliance. Events will include a silent auction featuring local quilts, art, and other artifacts of interest, dinner and music by General Strike, and a special musical roast of the Mainstream Press by Melinda Pittman, founder of the Fallen Angel Choir. Enjoy an evening of food, friends, and music while supporting your independent media news, the Portland Alliance. This event will be held at St. Andrew Catholic Church Community Center, 806 Northeast Alberta Avenue in Portland. Advance tickets may be purchased by calling 503-239-4991 or by logging on to www.theportlandalliance.org. That's Saturday, December 9th, beginning at 6 p.m. KBOO is proud to co-sponsor this event.
The time is 6 o'clock p.m. Stay tuned for Bread and Roses. The KBOO program, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from, in other words, Women's Books and Resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingsworth at Williams. In other words, is your local, nonprofit, feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003 or inotherwords.org. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for Bread and Roses. We'll be right back.
Good evening. Well, that should have woken you up. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and you're listening to Bread and Roses, our weekly women's news and public affairs program. And I'm excited about tonight's show. I've been wanting to put this program together for a long time, actually. My name is Gabriela Ross, and I have two guests in the studio to talk about gambling, and particularly problem gambling as it relates to women. I have with me tonight Marcia Martoso and Peter Walsh, who work with Cascadia Mental Health. Good evening, and thanks for coming on a Friday night.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. To get started, do you want to say a little bit about yourself, about your jobs, and how you got to be interested in this particular issue?
Well, I'm from Brazil originally, and I came here 13 years ago, and I did my master's degree in marriage and family therapy, and I decided to get to work, and I got to Cascadia Behavioral Health Care in a gambling program, and I have been there, has been 6 years, and one of my specialties is women gamblers.
And for me, it was when I got out of school, kind of a midlife change of careers, looking around to see that perhaps a private practice wouldn't be the way to go because all the jobs were in addictions. I started first working at a place called Network Behavioral Healthcare, doing their Dewey Diversion programs. And then on the same floor was a gambling program, and they seemed to be having a lot more fun than the folks doing the Dewey programs. So I applied for a job there, and here we are 7 years later.
Huh. And Cascadia Mental Health is one of the primary providers for counseling regarding gambling issues. Is that correct, in this region?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. We actually have the largest gambling treatment program in the state, if not the country. We have 8 counselors in Portland and 5 in Salem. Mm.
And we're going to hire another one.
That's correct. And we just opened the first of a kind residential treatment program in Salem for gamblers, the first one in the state, and one of only a handful on the West Coast.
And we will take calls throughout the show. So in a little while, I will announce the number if anybody have any questions regarding the topic tonight. But to start off with, lots of people gamble. Lots of people play bingo. Lots of people do all kinds of stuff. How would you recognize a problem gambler?
Well, they have few characteristics, especially regarding to money and time. You know, problem gamblers, they usually spend more than the average gambler with gambling. If you gamble socially, you spend maybe $20. You know, some people tell me, well, I separate $50 to gamble and have some fun. But if you are a gambling addict, you won't have just $20. You can start with $20, and you're going to even think about, okay, I'm just going to gamble $20. But if you are a compulsive gambler, you're not going to stop there. Even if you have only, let's say, $200, this is for my grocery money for the whole month. If you're a compulsive gambler, they're going to go and spend most likely everything. So if you're in a bar or in a restaurant where they have the machines in there, you can observe from a distance people pouring in, you know, staying there. And now regarding to time, an hour, maybe 2 hours, and they're not even aware that they have been there for an hour, 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So time is an incredible thing for gamblers who are addicts.
And that's most of the folks that come in for treatment. They usually come in saying, I have a financial problem around money, and they want us to help them in that regard. But what they learn to, what we teach them eventually is that there's a lot of other areas that they have been impacted by their gambling, their family life, their work life. They may be isolating more from friends, from family members. They may be not doing activities that they used to enjoy. It does become a compulsive behavior where they may be thinking about gambling, about where they're going to go, when they're going to go, where they're going to get the money to gamble with, what they're going to tell their family members, what kind of excuses they may make up, that type of thing. We call it a hidden addiction because you can't smell it on someone's breath. You can't see it in their eyes. But if you inspect their checkbook carefully, which we do urge spouses to do or partners of gamblers, you'll see those strange financial dealings that they often deal in.
their whole life is when a person becomes addicted to gambling, their whole life is around gambling. You know, often clients will tell us, when I wake up, I think about gambling. When I'm at work, I think about gambling. In fact, many people at work, it's hard to concentrate in when you're thinking about gambling.
Mm-hmm.
So many people will even commit illegal acts such, you know, forgery or embezzle their business, you know, the boss's money in order to gamble. Mm-hmm. So, it affects, like Peter said, their family life, affects their work life, affects the whole being, their physical being, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sorry, because we work with gamblers all the time, you know, we certainly are in that mode of thinking that everybody has a problem gambling, but that's not true. The majority of folks can gamble recreationally. And there was just a recent prevalence study in Oregon where 2.7% of the population is either a problem or pathological gambler. So, but that still equals to 60 to 80,000 Oregonians.
That's a lot of people.
Yes.
There is some, I found some quizzes on the line, some like self-check kind of quizzes to see if you may be in that category. And the questions seem to center around some of the things you point out, like do you spend more money than you plan to? Do you spend more time than you plan to? And do you lie about it to your family?
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I was going to say, because you don't want to let people know, especially your spouse or partner, mm-hmm. that you just spent $200. So they really are, they become professional liars
mm-hmm.
because they can, you know, they feel that they cannot tell the truth.
Now, in my other life, I work with children, with young people who have struggled with addiction issues. And I think for many people, it's not that difficult anymore to wrap their brains around being addicted to drugs or alcohol, because you put a chemical in your body and certain processes happen and you have withdrawals if you quit mm-hmm. and all these mm-hmm. kind of things. But I think it's still harder to understand for many people how gambling may be addictive. Could you speak a little bit about what little maybe it is we know about the brain and what's the addictive quality?
Sure. There are some, you know, we call gambling a process addiction. You're just like you're talking about it. You're not ingesting a substance. You are doing a behavior. It's similar in some ways to a shopping addiction or perhaps a food addiction or a sex addiction, something of that sort. It's a behavior. But nevertheless, it does affect the neurochemistry in the brain. Dopamine levels elevate, adrenaline levels elevate. There's also some evidence to show that problem gamblers have differences in their prefrontal cortex in terms of decision-making or being able to delay gratification.
Mm-hmm.
So there's brain research going on specific to gambling with PET scans and things of that sort. And we do know that the same areas of the brain are activated when someone gambles as when someone is doing stimulants such as meth or mm-hmm. cocaine. So we do see there is a biological cause, but it's also, you know, environmental. You know, it's that biopsychosocial environment that we all are in. So, but nevertheless, neurotransmitters are impacted.
Mm. And in you were recently, I'm referring to Peter Walsh, the program director for the program at Cascade Mental Health Services. You were recently interviewed in an Oregonian article, and that article talks about that in 1996 there was that only 37.2% of all people who sought treatment for gambling problems were women, and now it's over 50%. So
mm-hmm.
now
mm-hmm.
it appears that the majority of people who seek help for gambling problems are female. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going on there? Where is that coming from?
Well, I think gambling is more accepted by society, and not just accepted, but also promoted. You know, you have many churches doing bingos.
You're supporting a chorus.
Yeah.
That's right.
And you can say before, in fact, gambling was like gambling, but then became entertainment. And now it's family entertainment. If you can take your whole family to Vegas. In fact, people think there is a status in that. Oh, I'm going to go to Vegas. So I think that's one of the factors for women to be so unease, you know, to gamble. And also, it's not just in the casinos anymore. Now you can go to a bar, even a restaurant, you know, by yourself and with your family, you're safe. In fact, we have women telling us that they go, you know, where can they go to like 10 o'clock and feel safe?
That's right.
In a restaurant, they can go there and they're safe. So I think the availability for women and acceptability for women are, you know.
Correct. I mean, Marcy is talking about, you know, there used to be a moral prohibition on gambling. Now it's much more accepted by society, states, nations, countries. It's not just Oregon. It's all over the world that gambling has increased. But also in terms of women gambling, a little over a year ago, the lottery also introduced what they call line games. These are slot machine, electronic slot games. For example, when you go into a bar or restaurant, there's the most video poker machines they can have. They can have six video poker machines. Those are what they call platforms. And so when they introduced a little over a year ago, the same machine, you can either play video poker or you can play slots. And we do know that the majority of slots players in casinos are women. It seems to be an activity that women enjoy. It's a wonderful escape. It's entertaining, and just like the casinos are safe places, many of these bars are also, or restaurants are safe places. So we're starting to see anecdotally in our treatment areas more women coming in who are having slots problems, or they previously played video poker, and now that the slots are here, they're starting to partake of them. We had people even before the slots came out with concerns that, you know, I'm safe right now because I have to travel 50 miles to Spirit Mountain to play slots, but I'm very concerned now because they're on every corner.
And there seems to be some differences in what attracts women to gambling as opposed to what attracts men, maybe. What are some of those differences?
Well, just in general, I mean, for one thing, in Oregon, we probably have the widest array of gambling activities of any state in the country, from, you know, video poker to slots to sports action to casinos-style gambling. It's a wide array of gambling activities. In general, women have been more attracted to games where there's not direct competition, perhaps with another player. We're talking perhaps poker games or card games of that sort. So that's why perhaps the slots are more popular, or even video poker, because you're there with yourself in front of the machine. I don't know if you can speak to more of that, Marcy.
Yes, at least my experience in my practice is that they are there to zone out. They're not there to compete with the machine, as Peter was saying. They're there to zone out because they're tired of being a wife. They're tired of being abused by their husbands or partners or their bosses, or they're tired of being a mom or a grandmother. You know, when they are there, they tell us, I don't think about anything. And most women, they gamble as an escape. They don't want to think about anything. They don't want to think about their bills. You know, some of them work really hard and sometimes don't have enough to pay their bills, so they go gamble. In fact, you know, sometimes I put on a board, okay, so you don't have enough money to pay your bills, and then what's the solution? You go gamble. is that working for you? And of course, we all know it doesn't. About a month ago, I asked the group of women. I said, there were 10 women in the group. I said, how much money have you lost due to gambling? $3 million. Just 10 women. And I did that about 6 months ago. We had, I think, about 13 women, and was $1.6 million due to gambling. So it's a lot of money, you know. And even though they think I need money, I'm going to go gamble so I can get money. But when you cross the line from social gambler to addictive, to addicted gambler, you don't have power anymore to hold the winnings. Doesn't matter if you win. Mm-hmm. When you're a gambler, you're just there to play the game. That's it. You lose your control.
You're there to continue the escape.
Yes, to continue. And it's the same as, you know, with drug and alcohol. Mm-hmm. Same thing. They get the drug to get high and to forget about whatever. Mm-hmm. But women, they're there because they want to escape. They don't want to think about anything else but be there. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard that.
And for many women that we see, they may have raised families, they may have budgeted the family money, they may have had jobs, they may have been professional people, and they come to a point in their life where there's maybe the children have left home, maybe they've gone through a divorce, maybe they've lost their job, maybe they've lost a partner, and despite all these things, they may not even have had a history of alcohol and drug issues, and then they find the solace of a video poker machine or a slot machine, and it can be comforting, and it at first can be also a social activity, but then it becomes less and less that.
Mm-hmm. That's true, because they think it is social, because people, you know, you have people around, and many times we have many clients telling us that they went to gamble with somebody else, a coworker. But then when they become addicted to gambling, they don't want to be bothered. They want to be there alone. They don't want anybody to come and talk to them. We had, again, people telling us that when they're gambling, they even avoid eating or drinking because they don't want to stop to go to the bathroom. The max that I have seen in my practice being there, most likely in the casino, gambling was 36 hours straight without stopping. And in fact, some casinos even changed their seating. It's not cloth anymore, you know, because the soil. Some people that will refuse to go to the bathroom because they're so zoned out into the machine that they will refuse to go to the bathroom, if you will. So
if it's the case that rather than seeking challenge and competition, women may seek escape, do you offer a different approach in how you try to help them than you would for males who come to you for?
Absolutely. You know, most women gamblers want to work on, well, they're probably more adept at wanting to delve into the reasons for their gambling and probably, I don't want to stereotype this, but want to reconnect with the things that they used to do before. They are perhaps going to GA or something like that. Maybe, Marcy, you can talk more about that. Well, because you ran the women's group for a period of time.
4 years.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm thinking about your question, and in the beginning, maybe the man, they are more, they want to resolve the problem. Mm. They want to quit, you know. But the women, most of the time, are open to go deeper. However, I have to say that maybe mid-treatment, you know, into treatment, or at the, almost like into 4 months into treatment, both men and women are almost on the same page. Not, I think women are, you know, even more open to deal with their issues that brought them there first, you know, first of all. But men, I think, later, they become comfortable. It's, in fact, when I was doing a men's group, they were, the average people there were in treatment for about 6 months. And if you would type the words, you would not recognize. That was my assessment. I would not recognize if it were a man or a women's group. Mm. Because they were talking about their heart. They were talking about their feelings. They were talking about their relationships, their problems, in talking about being better you know, men and men in their relationship. I was amazed to see that. So maybe in the beginning, you know, the women are more ready to make some changes and deal with the issue. But I don't know. What do you think, Peter?
One of the things we see both with men and women, but probably more with women, is a history of trauma in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just with gambling. We see that in alcohol and drug issues as well, or addictions, that there can be a history of trauma. And so whether that's childhood abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse from childhood or from partners that they've lived with, the women are more likely to delve into those issues than the men are, more likely to work on those issues and understand them. Men are a bit more reluctant to do that, but not to say that they don't have similar issues as well.
So we try to make a safe environment for them, as supportive as we can. We have a group just for women, as we talked about that, and just for men. And when, you know, I had the group for 4 years, and they are so supportive of each other. You know, we talk about everything, not just about gambling. We talk about relationship issues. We talk about sex issues. We talk about financial issues. We talk about conflict resolution, communication. You know, we support them in all the areas they need support, not just gambling, because gambling is like at the tip of the iceberg. You know, what is beneath that? That's what we try at Cascadia Behavioral Health Care to address and help them to deal with these issues that they have been running from.
That's absolutely correct. It's not just the gambling. We know that for both men and women, those that do the best have family members participate in treatment with them. And we're fortunate with the way the gambling funds are set up that we can provide couples counseling, family counseling, family education groups, couples education groups, and not only but partners or other family members, but children can come in as well. And I'm talking, we've probably mostly dealt with adolescents on a few occasions. So it's not just the gambling. It's reestablishing relationships. It's learning how to do relationships again, learning how to communicate, learning how to have fun in your life again. And gambling, you know, for many of the gamblers, both men and women, gambling has been such an exciting activity for such a long time that there's going to be a certain amount of dysphoria around their life when they're not gambling. A dysphoric mood is going to be there, and their other things are not going to be as exciting. So it takes time.
Like with any substance.
Exactly. It's hard to believe, but it's true with the gambling.
One of the things that I did when I was in a group was to help them to be present. Because, as Peter is saying, you know, to match the euphoria of gambling is really hard. They are really, you know, gambling gives them, again, the same high as a cocaine addict. They're up there. So when you stop that, your glass is empty. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? We coach them to go through this process, and one of the tools we give them is to try to be mindful, try to be present, you know, breathe. When you eat, be focused in what you're eating. When you're doing exercise, when you're having vacations, in fact, leisure is, you know, it's a big part of our treatment tool that we give them. We encourage them to have time to relax, to rest with by themselves or with their family. We have many people in our program who are workaholics, you know, managers, and they work. In fact, because of that, many could relapse. You know, they try to avoid everything and dive into work. This is not the best thing to do. The best thing to do is to take care of yourself, but as a whole, you know, as a whole being, your spiritual life, your physical life, your mental health life, your relationship life, your whole being.
And for many women, that's not something they've been doing. They've been caretakers all their lives.
Yes.
They may have grown up in a family where they were the adult child. They were a caretaker there. They get into relationships where they're oftentimes the caretakers. They have children, they're caretakers. So they come to this point where they don't know what their own needs are, and so we have to help them to identify those needs.
That's so true. I'm talking to Marcia and to Peter, who work with Cascadia Behavioral Health. I think I've said it wrong in the beginning. And I want to invite people, if you have any questions regarding gambling, particularly regarding problem gambling and women, to call with your questions. The number to call is 503-231-8187. So again, if you have any questions for our guests, call 503-231-8187. And we will give you phone numbers and websites and stuff towards the end of the show if you want to do some look into this issue some more on your own. When I was talking to my partner today about I was going to do this show, he said something interesting. He's an engineer, so he really doesn't know much about the world of social services and all that. He assumed somehow that the people who gamble are somehow economically desperate and hope that this is a ticket out. And I have a hinge that this is probably not true very much. Can you give me like a sample profile of what maybe, and I understand there may be many different types of people, but what may be like a typical gambler?
I think Marcy has some statistics around that, but let me just say from our experience, it's an equal opportunity addiction. We see folks that are on disability, perhaps maybe have a mental illness and have their needs taken care of and have a small allowance for, you know, necessities during the week. They can become problem gamblers. We have folks on the other end of the spectrum that make over $100,000 a year. Marcy was talking about, you know, jobs with a lot of responsibility and stressful situations. Those folks can become problem gamblers. It's equal opportunity, but we do have some statistics about the majority of folks that we see in our treatment programs. Which ones are those, Marcy?
Well, for instance, the average people are 59% of people who we see are employed. And their average annual household income is $36,000. So, in fact, we have many people who make more money than we do. Right, Peter?
That's for sure.
So, you know, it's not that they're... Now, it's true that when you become a compulsive gambler, you are desperate for money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have... In average, people who come to our services in Oregon for treatment, in average, they gamble about $300 or more a day. So if you multiply that for, you know, by 30, you know, uh-huh, how much money they spend a month, how can a person survive with that?
Uh-huh.
You know, and then another thing, though, when you look at where the video poker machines are, they're usually in taverns, bars and taverns. Where are those bars and taverns located? There's probably more in the southeast, probably more in the northeast, probably more in North Portland, probably fewer in West Lynn, Lake Oswego, places like that. So you can start, you know, wondering about those types of situations, and it might be going closer to what you uh-huh first were talking about.
Uh-huh. I understand we do have a caller, so maybe we can bring the person on there and see you. Hello? Can you hear me? Hello, good evening.
Yes. Okay. I'm calling regarding my partner, who I recently discovered has some kind of addiction to computer inappropriateness. I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
And I'm wondering about how much time it would take for a person who has, isn't it dopamine, that the chemical in the brain that's either too much or too little?
Yes.
Please
elucidate that on that. Maybe new information. It was brand new for me when I went to an addictions seminar, you might say, a couple hours on a Sunday afternoon. And I think that's important information, but I truly would like to know what time frame the healing process, you might say, can take for someone with that sort of dysfunctionality.
Okay, thank
you. And I can take my answer off the air, and, you know, you can run with what I've given you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think for each situation, you know, it depends upon the individual.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that with gambling specific, there is a period of what we call post-acute withdrawal from gambling, just like with drugs and alcohol. And that varies from person to person. It can be a period of a month, 45 days, 2 months, or something of that sort. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's when the dopamine levels are getting back to normal, but that's when this action phase that they may be in starts to level off and they start to get a better perspective on their lives. As far as the dopamine goes, you know, there's the research in gambling is just in the infancy stages. Probably in the last 5 years, we've seen more research than we've seen in, you know, well, forever in gambling. But that's a difficult question to answer as far as when the dopamine is going to get back to a level that might be more normal. All I can say is it probably depends on the individual. I don't know if, Marcy, you have something more on that.
Well, I think I was talking to someone about this. Interesting enough that when you have alcohol or drug, supposedly you're off of it for a day, you're back to quasi-normal, if you will. But gambling, even if you're off of gambling a day, you're still drunk with gambling. You're still having the symptoms. You know, you think about it, you're disoriented. We have people that even after a month being abstinent from gambling, they will tell us they're numb, they don't think right. So as Peter was saying, the level of normalcy is going to be different for everybody. We have the withdrawal symptoms, you know, related to gambling as well, even though it's not an intake of any substance, but the symptoms, the withdrawal symptoms are similar to drug and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
They become irritable, they're anxious, they're having sleep disturbances. So until they get back to normal, it can take a month, 2, 3 months, 6 months, you know, it will depend.
And I think a measure of that, perhaps, for an individual might be going back to what we talked about before, that dysphoric mood or that what we call anhedonia, that feeling, the lack of pleasure in activities that are not gambling.
Yes.
So for the caller, perhaps her partner, whatever computer activity that person does, is that exciting activity. And when that person is away from it, how long does it take for other activities that were previously fun, exciting, to take the place of that computer activity? So that might be a measure of the neurotransmitters going back to a more normal level.
And computer is highly addictive as well. It's kind of hard to measure up with the same activities.
And I think we have another caller. Hello?
Hi, my name is Liz. I was wondering about, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
It seems like our state has become more and more dependent upon gambling revenues. I can remember a time when we didn't have gambling here in Oregon. And I'm just wondering, you know, has the incidence of gambling addiction gone up since we have now, you know, the state is now using gambling to fill in some of our budget shortfalls?
From everything, from education to everything, yeah. Okay, can you want to take your call off the air?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for calling in. And this may be a good time to look a little bit at the history of gambling in Oregon and whether or not there is a correlation to more of a problem with problem gambling.
That was a good point. For instance, in 1986, gambling revenues in Oregon were $95 million. And Peter has mentioned before that today it's over $1 billion. So 1986 to 2006, 20 years later, from $95 million, we have over $1 billion in revenue with gambling.
But I think the prevalence of problem and pathological gamblers has actually stayed relatively the same. It's anywhere, when we do measurements of that sort, not just in Oregon, but across the country and in the world, it generally hovers between 2 to 3% problem or pathological gamblers. And that's doing prevalence studies on that issue. I don't think it has increased in Oregon. What has increased is access to treatment, and that might be one reason why we've stayed at a certain level. Oregon is actually probably the foremost state in the United States to provide treatment. I know it's a deal with the devil in a certain way. The state does make a lot of money off of gambling revenue, but they also provide free treatment for gamblers and for their family members. And it's confidential, it's free, and it's effective. Over 80% of problem gamblers report that after 6 months after leaving treatment, they've either reduced their gambling or curtailed their gambling completely. That's a pretty nice statistic. But nevertheless, there's a reason for us being here, being gambling counselors.
So treatment works. But this is from another Oregonian article. In 2005-2006, the state of Oregon made $483.6 million off various forms of gambling. And this, of course, this money goes to everything, from education to environmental stuff. Out of that money, $4.6 million were allocated to services such as yours to helping people with gambling addiction. And there is, of course, something kind of bizarre about that, to use the funds from the place where the problem starts to then address the problems. Do you have any thoughts on that issue?
Well, I guess one of the questions, when a client brings that up, one of the questions we say is, well, that's not the reason you're here first. But the second thing we say is, are you willing to pay more taxes? Are you willing to pay higher taxes? And, you know, that has been such a shift, such a movement in the country for years. No new taxes, read my lips, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So, no, they have to think about that. It's an easy way for states to make revenue. There is a downside. And, you know, by the same token, there's a large tax on alcohol and tobacco. And the state reaps, you know, money from that as well.
Right.
And treatment is provided from that as well.
Right.
So do you start going down that slippery slope of saying no gambling, no alcohol, no tobacco? And then
that would be nice.
I also wondered if the fact that it is the way it is, that's the money... A huge chunk of the money provided to help people comes from the industry, the gambling industry. Does that in any way compromise the treatment? Like, for example, when I read through some of the resources online, the terminology kind of struck me. Like, I don't think we talk anymore so much about controlled drinking, but we do talk about controlled gambling. Or we don't talk about so much problem drug abuse. We talk about drug abuse. So do you think that it may be possible that it compromises or kind of softens prevention and treatment approaches to gambling?
I think we have, honestly, one of the best treatments in the United States. I really feel privileged to work for gamblers who are totally devastated, mm-hmm. and the state has really been a great help in this regard, giving 1% of their profit towards treatment. And they, at least, you know, I have been working there for 6 years, and I have heard all the people who have been working there for 12 years. They have, the state, you know, who the lottery has no requirements for us to treat less or to do this less, mm-hmm. because they want them to keep gambling. No, they give the money and we do our work.
So there's no strings attached?
No.
There are no strings attached, no.
No strings, yeah. We do our work, and our work is to help them to be abstinent or to reduce their gambling mm-hmm. addiction. And most people, let me tell you, most people, they opt to be abstinent from gambling. I think 90%, at least I think, 90% of our clients go for abstinence. And as Peter said, it's over 80%, about 80 to 85% of people who come to treatment become abstinent from gambling.
So that's if you compare to drug and alcohol treatment,
that's incredible.
And you know, going back a little bit about your question, talking about perhaps compromising language, well, you could look at something like harm reduction as compromising mm-hmm. language. But nevertheless, we do use harm reduction techniques in gambling. On the way towards abstinence, many folks, you know, want to control their gambling. And we say, okay, that sounds good. Let's set it up for you. Let's see how we can help you control it. So they have to come to that decision on their own with our guidance through the process. Uh-huh. On the other hand, gambling is an interesting activity because video poker may be the primary form of gambling, the one that gets them into trouble the most, but they also may play cribbage or they may do something else like a bingo or something like that. So there's a lot of discussion in the treatment world. Should they abstain from all those forms of gambling or just the video poker? Uh-huh. And we do know that there are some folks that if they abstain from video poker, they may be able to do some of these other activities. But what we recommend to them is when they're doing this, especially when they're in our program and they're, you know, trying to enter recovery from problem gambling, is that we ask that they monitor those other activities. If you go and get a buy a scratcher, if you go and play bingo, how is that impacting you? What do you feel like while you're doing it? Do you want to do it some more to replace the video poker? Are you spending more time doing that type of thing? So we ask them to examine that activity as well. So in that sense, that's another way of looking at harm reduction too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. To become aware of their behavior. Because when they become addicted to gambling, they lose awareness. We ask them, how much money have you lost due to gambling? The majority of people will tell us, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because consciously, they don't want to know. Mm-hmm. They don't want to know that they have lost already $10,000, $20,000. They don't want to know they are spending maybe 2 hours a day, 10 hours a week, you know, a week, 20, 30, just gambling. They don't want to know that. They prefer not knowing that. And part of treatment is to raise their awareness about their behavior in every aspect, not just gambling. But as Peter said, you know, if they start gambling or playing the computer games or any other kind of game, they, you know, okay, how am I doing this? Am I spending 2 or 3 hours of my day playing this game? Even though it's not, you know, some people will play in a game and not spend any money. Mm-hmm. But we encourage them to monitor, as Peter was saying, their behavior in with everything.
Mm-hmm. You're still listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. You're listening to Bread and Roses, our Women's News and Public Affairs program. I'm talking with Marcia and Peter from Cascadia Behavioral Health about gambling, and particularly problem gambling for women. If you have any questions, you can call 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Before the show, you mentioned briefly, I work with young people, and one of you mentioned briefly that this seems to be, it's not just adults that are entering this world of gambling, problem gambling. You want to say a little bit about that?
Well, you can probably go to your local department store this time of year and pick up a lovely gambling game that may end up in the stocking of one of your children. Texas Hold'em games are very popular. Parents, you know, think that if their kids, their teen children, their middle school children, are playing a card game in the basement, that they are not drinking alcohol, they're not running around buying, you know, illegal substances, they're not driving under the influence, they're down there in the basement, they're just gambling. Well, we do know that there is a risk, and there is a connection between gambling and other high-risk activities. We're not saying that that gambling causes these other activities, but we do know that there is a correlation. For example, the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey just came out. It's a survey that is, I believe, funded by the state, and they finally added some gambling questions in there and some comparisons with gambling and other high-risk activities. For example, they asked eighth graders, have you had beer or wine or hard liquor to drink during the past 30 days? And non-gamblers of the eighth grade, 26% of them said they had drank. For gamblers, almost 49% said that they had drank. So, and then the same question for 11th graders. Non-gamblers, 41% said they drank. Gamblers, 60% said they drank. So there was a correlation as far as high-risk activities go. Of course, we all know that, you know, if you tell a teen that just stop it or it's a high-risk activity, they're going to disagree with that because that's what they do. Risk is all about being being a teen. But these are interesting correlations, and we do see it. I think the prevalence is higher. I talked about between 2 and 3% of the population at large having a gambling problem. For teens, I believe it's closer to 5 to 10%, something of that sort. I don't have that statistic at hand.
And what can teens legally access in terms of, like, can they go in the bars? Or they can't go in the bars anyway, but in a restaurant and use the machines?
Supposedly not. What they can access, and I'm not exactly sure of that, but there are some casinos where, and I'm not sure which one's in Oregon, but I do know in Washington, and this may have changed recently, but you only have to be 18 to go into a casino. So
in some states, you can be, they allow 16 years old to go and gamble as well.
There's also social gaming as well. We're talking about, I think Marcy mentioned bingo or church activities, right, things of that sort, poker nights. Teens could access those.
And I also want to comment, you know, about the games, the video games especially. You know, many children, they start video playing 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old. Parents buy games. And in the brain, I can't describe you exactly the research that I read, but in the brain, it's almost like we are training the brain to be used to that kind of pattern. Have you watched people, when I go to Walmart, Kmart, any, you know, market like this, I have seen the little boys, even adults, playing the games. And you know, when you see them, I have observed them. They're flushed. Their faces are red. They don't see anybody. They're totally focused. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we see as counselors today in our office. They started with a social, very very fun game at home. No money involved or anything like that. But then now, you know, with the gambling, is just a step from one thing to another. It's the same, almost the same pattern. It's a video thing right there for me to play.
And we haven't seen that many teens coming into treatment. We're just not seeing them. And as we're trying to make more efforts in terms of getting treatment for teens, awareness for teens and parents. They just do not show. And I don't know if there's any correlation directly between video games and video poker or gambling. I think, you know, we think as treatment folks that there might likely be one, like Marcy's talking about, but there hasn't been any specific research on that to show that. And, you know, maybe there's some hesitancy on folks that do research to look into that.
Anything else about gambling and problem gambling and women that you'd like to point out to us?
Well, I would like to encourage people who are listening to us to make the call for help. We have, as Peter mentioned, one of the best treatment in the nation. You know, Oregon has, as we mentioned before, supported treatment. And we have the privilege to give treatment for anybody, men and women, for the gambler and also for their family. And it is free, completely free, no cost.
That was my next question.
Completely free.
Yes.
And it's not just, I mean, Marcy says for the gambler and for the family members. So what that means is that a family member without the gambler can come to treatment. Mm-hmm. If they have a problem gambler at home, they can come and receive treatment, support, education, and the gambler doesn't even have to be there.
And how do people find you?
Well, you can call the helpline. The number is 1-877-278-6766. Again, the number is for gambling helpline, 1-877-278-6766. This is the helpline, and they will direct you to your nearest agency. But our agency is Cascadia Behavioral Health Care. We are located at, Peter?
We're at 43rd and Division in the southeast here, and our gambling intake number is 503-239-5952. So, and I can say that again, 239-5952.
And the hotline was a 24-hour number?
Yes,
24-hour
number. Okay. And we have gamblers that carry a card around with that hotline number on it. They can call if they're in crisis on weekends in the middle of the night. It's staffed 24 hours a day. And like Marcy said, they get referred to the nearest gambling treatment center in the state. I think now there's 28 centers or places they can receive treatment in across the state.
Okay. Anything else about gambling problems? And I so appreciate you coming in on a Friday night. You probably have a zillion other things to do.
Well, you know, I think one thing is we really appreciate you inviting us on here.
Yes.
An issue that we find over and over again is the lack of knowledge on the public's part that gambling can be an issue. Mm-hmm. Once again, there's going back to what we talked about earlier. A lot of folks think it's a moral issue, or it's a matter of willpower. Why can't you just stop? And there's not that much awareness around that. We are getting more awareness raising the public awareness that gambling is an issue, that gambling can be a problem, and we also are getting more awareness that treatment is out there. So that's our job, and we really appreciate, you know, when folks like you have us on the air so we can talk about that treatment is available.
Yes, and, you know, Peter mentioned one thing that I want to say. Gambling can be a problem. It's not for the majority, but if you think, for instance, in 34%, as I said, has committed illegal acts to gamble, in order to gamble. So it affects our society. It affects our state. It affects people's lives. So
we had some rather prominent cases in Portland, like city managers embezzling amounts of money because, you know, of gambling.
That's correct. In fact, that's how that Oregonian article came about. Mm. The same reporter was doing an article on the woman in West Lynn who had embezzled from the city. And so she kind of, it piqued her interest in, you know, how can this happen? And so she started talking to us about treatment and women and gambling. And so this whole thing has kind of snowballed from that article.
Exactly. And, for instance, 27% lost a marriage or a significant relationship due to gambling. So it impacts. It's a real issue. It's a real problem that we need to address. And I'm very thankful that we have this 1% fund to do treatment.
We also have a program at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is the women's institution down in Wilsonville. We started it about 2.5 years ago, and it's called the GEAR program, and it's a workbook program. In other words, there's a cognitive behavioral workbook that they can work through with the counselor. It's not counseling as much as education, and since we started the program 2.5 years ago, over 222 women have gone through the program. And that's for folks that are going to be released within they're in 6 months of release. And so they're urged to go to that program. And not only just those who may think they have problem gambling, but those that may have family members with problem gambling issues. Because either one could lead to recidivism once they are released. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see, because in the treatment communities, A&D treatment, they may have A&D treatment within the facility there. Gambling didn't exist in the treatment. It didn't exist until we brought it in. And so their eyes are just, and the awareness that goes on is just amazing when they start seeing this. And one of the main things is raising awareness for those women and also letting them know that treatment does exist when they're out and when they're released. So it's been a great project. And anecdotally, we've seen folks who have gone through that, some of them enter outpatient treatment or have family members that enter outpatient treatment.
So one more time, thank you very much, Marcia and Peter from Cascadia Behavioral Health, for coming in and talking to us about women and gambling and problem gambling in general. This was Brendan Roses on KBO 90.7 FM. And if you could give the hotline number one more time before we go. And I want to also announce briefly a totally unrelated event. The number is 1-877-278-6766.
Or as it's known as 1-877-2-STOP-NOW.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
The other event I want to quickly announce is some of you may have heard Susan Swift, rather Susan Swift's mother on this program talking about sexual abuse in the military. She will be at Portland State University at Smith Center this Sunday, starting in an event that starts at 10 a.m., I believe, and goes, 10 a.m., PSU Multicultural Center, Smith Center, Susan Swift, and other people talking about sexual abuse in the military. Thank you so much for listening to Bread and Roses on KBO 90.7 FM, and good evening.
Olúwọlọ́run àgbálá ayé ọba nìkan ṣoṣọ ni tó mọ ohun gbogbo tí ó sì lè ṣe ohun gbogbo. Àwa péjọ ní òní níwájú rẹ láti wá ṣe ohun ribiribi tó jẹ́ wípé a mọ̀ wípé yóò jẹ́ ìtẹ́wọ́gbà níwájú rẹ. Àwa péjọ ní ìbáyìí lónìí ọlọ́run àgbálá ayé ohun gbogbo tá ò bá ṣe mọ́sà jẹ́ kí o máa ṣe àmọ̀ná wa nínú rẹ̀. A fi ọwọ́ ara àti ohun wa àwa fi sí abẹ́ ẹ̀ṣọ́ rẹ nítorí pé ìwọ nìkan ni ẹni tí ó lè ràn wá lọ́wọ́. Wá darí ìṣe wa, wá darí orin wa, wá darí ohun gbogbo tí a ó ṣe. Jẹ́ kí ohun gbogbo tí a ó ṣe kí ó jẹ́ ìtẹ́wọ́gbà lọ́wọ́ gbogbo aráyé, kí wọn kí ó sì lè mọ̀ wípé àwa fi ohun wa àti ara wa yàn lógo. Èdùmọ̀rì ọlọ́jọ́ òní ẹnìkan ṣoṣo tó jẹ́ wípé òun ló mọ ohun gbogbo tí ó sì lè ṣe ohun gbogbo. A fi ara wa sí abẹ́ ẹ̀ṣọ́ rẹ wà pẹ̀lú wa torí ìwọ nìkan ni alágbàláṣẹ. Àmì.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. For information, please call 503-335-9758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.